Save big money right now at Menards. From smoke and carbon monoxide detectors to fire extinguishers and more, Kit of Home Safety products keep your family protected in case of emergencies. Smoke and carbon monoxide detectors are perfect for your living spaces, offering protection and peace of mind. Save big money on all Kit of products at Menards. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money at Menards.
Let's find a competition to your soul. Let's find a competition to your soul and the
Hello, Kristen Chez. It's Derek. I am here to, I have to say, I'm not here with Danny, as I usually am for the news. I think he's off trying to appeal his sanctions with the Russian government. So he won't be available this week. But I am very pleased to be joined once again by Alex Jourdan. Alex is from the Quincy Institute. He's been here before. I don't think I need to do the full introduction. You guys have heard him step in for both of us on the news before. So, Alex, thanks for coming back. We appreciate it.
I'm always happy to join when one of you goes gallivanting across the world.
So, we'll talk about your show at the end. You can give people the pitch for that. I do have one pitch before we get started, which is to let listeners know, if you're interested, we have somewhere in the American Prestige warehouse discovered another limited supply of our Robo Washington Crossing the Delaware posters. We sold these around, I think, the 4th of July weekend, if people recall. There are a few more left if anybody is interested. They're 18 by 24. They've got some great artwork by Josh Lynch. They sell for $30. Paid subscribers to American Prestige get a 50% discount. You should have a discount code if you're a paid subscriber. If you haven't received that, or if you deleted that email, you can always reach out to us, and we'll be happy to supply it again. But if anybody's interested and you didn't jump on that sale the first time we had a run, we do have a few more to offer. The link, it's AmericanPrestigeStore.com, but the link will be in the show notes here for you to just click on and do that. So get them while they're hot. I don't think there's maybe 20 or so left. So get them while we have them. So with that, Alex, let's get into the news.
Let's do it.
Always good news. Good news as always.
As always, yeah.
We're starting off with a banger, right? Yes. Climate news. Climate news is always a good sign when we start off with that.
Yeah. Derek, so yeah, there is a new study warning that the Atlantic circulation system is likely to collapse. So could you tell us, is that a good thing?
I guess it could be good for something. I don't entirely know. The Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation, or AMOC, which is the system that circulates warm water from the Caribbean up to the waters around Britain and Greenland, and then brings cold water from that area south to be warmed up. It is pretty vital to the continued functioning of, I guess, the planet Earth as we know it. And it is in serious danger, according to a new study, of collapsing. This has been something that climate scientists have been studying for a long time. They have focused mostly on the chances of the AMOC collapsing by the end of this century, by 2100. And those studies have all generally determined that the chances of that happening are fairly low. What sets this new study apart is that it took a longer-term horizon and looked at what are the chances of the AMOC collapsing after that, and found that they're pretty high, actually, or dangerously high. I mean, I don't want to say it's like a certainty, but there is a disturbingly high likelihood. that this is going to happen at some point, probably after 2100. But the concern is apparently in this modeling that if humanity doesn't intervene drastically in the next couple of decades, it could lock in the dissipation of the Amok, which would then not take place for another, you know, 50 to 100 years down the road. But it would likely, because this isn't a switch, it's not something that just switches off instantaneously. It would be a process. And by 2100, which is when all these other studies have been focusing, the chances of the current weakening severely would be pretty high under those circumstances. And that alone, I mean, you know, the collapse of the circulation system altogether would be cataclysmic, but even a substantial weakening would be fairly cataclysmic. So, yeah, I'm always happy to start off with a happy climate report.
Well, Derek, 22nd century, that's somebody else's problem.
Well, that's true. Yeah, we don't really need to worry about that so much. But we do have this next story, I think, is something that we can all worry about in our lifetimes. So that's good.
I love to think about what threatens me. Obviously, after I'm dead, I don't care. And I won't care for any future generations either. I'm happy to make that pledge to the
why sully your beautiful mind with future generations? They'll take care of themselves.
So we're seeing some headlines that Ukraine is pioneering new tactics in the use of AI and drone technology. What can we anticipate from this exciting field, Derek?
Only good things. This was in the Wall Street Journal a couple of days ago, reporting on the Ukrainian military's use of what's called swarm technology, which relies on artificial intelligence, to direct fleets of drones to act autonomously. They can then interface with each other to sort of organize their attacks in a more theoretically more effective way. The Ukrainians have been playing around with this stuff with small groups of drones, so you know, a few at a time. But they're planning to ramp up, according to this piece, to fleets of tens, maybe 100 or more, as the technology, as they kind of play around with it. You could eventually see thousands potentially of drones, presumably small drones, probably suicide drones, they're called, used in this way where they're really autonomous of human operation. And, you know, a human's not going to be able to control that many drones at one time, but they can interact with each other and control their own movements. And then that leads, of course, inevitably to AI deciding who lives and dies on a battlefield or wherever, really. It doesn't have to be a battlefield, as it's not necessarily in the Russia-Ukraine conflict. So that would be the point at which I think people would have to start to worry. Ostensibly, I mean, we're told the Ukrainians are playing around with this. The United States has tested this kind of technology, this swarming technology. The Israeli government said back in 2021 that it was using something similar to this in Gaza. And then I don't think ever talked about it again, which is probably a bad sign.
Right.
But the idea is always, or we're told, every time, you know, a country engages in this sort of stuff, that there's always a human somewhere in the kill chain, as they euphemistically put it, who's ultimately responsible for making the decisions about life or death. But even if we assume that's true now, which I think you would not be forgiven for thinking it's bullshit, or you would be forgiven for thinking it's bullshit. But even if we assume it's true now, the likelihood that standard is going to be maintained, when it could mean, you know, greater operational efficiency, or, you know, just getting rid of people who cost a lot of money and replacing them with AI. I think the likelihood is pretty high that we will get to the point where AI is making life or death decisions, right, quite literally, in this context.
Well, and as you alluded to, there's already like pretty substantial reporting on AI being a significant part of targeting and some aspects of Israeli operations.
The Israelis are definitely using it now in Gaza to do targeting, and it's worked to horrific effects. I mean, you know, you've got AI making decisions about appropriate casualty levels, and, you know, the Israelis, you know, giving it parameters that, you know, it's okay if we kill, you know, 50 100 people to get one target, or if we attack these people in their homes where they're sure to be, along with their, you know, wives and children and parents and a right. bunch of civilians. Right. And that's the kind of decisions that are, those are the kind of decisions that are getting made with AI input.
Well, look, as long as somebody is getting rich, I'm happy.
Well, that is the happy side.
That's the upside. Well, while we're talking yeah. about Gaza, let's stick on the Israel-Palestine and general news items here. I know the IDF just declared Gaza City a, quote, dangerous combat zone, and Netanyahu has rejected the most recent Hamas statement on a ceasefire. So what does this portend for?
Yeah, this is, I mean, you know, the IDF has been now for a couple of weeks moving toward what ostensibly will be the conquest of Gaza City, or the reconquest. I mean, it depends on how many times you think it's already conquered Gaza City over the course of this genocide. But it has been advancing slowly, is still mostly, you know, most of its firepower and personnel are concentrated in kind of outskirt neighborhoods and suburbs of Gaza City. But as you say, on Friday, it did declare all of Gaza City a dangerous combat zone, which is the trigger, theoretically, for the estimated 1 million people who are living in and around Gaza City to leave and go to, you know, designated safe areas in the south. I say designated because they're not really safe, but right. The Israelis have called them that. The progress is slow going because primarily the IDF is waiting to mobilize tens of thousands of reservists, assuming that they actually report for duty. They called up about 60,000 reservists to participate in this new operation, which is finally going to be the thing that defeats Hamas. This is like the 12th time that we're definitely going to defeat Hamas. They've called up about 60,000 reservists, 40,000 of them in the initial wave to go into Gaza City and support this operation. That takes time to you know, get people called up, to get them to report, to mobilize them and deploy them. So it's slow going because of that. And there are questions about how many of them are actually going to show up because there's increasing opposition to putting reservists in harm's way for a conflict that seems to be just perpetually, you know, circling around on itself at this point. The other reason ostensibly is that the IDF is trying to at least put on a show of evacuating the civilian population, as I mentioned, about 1 million people. The Red Cross over the weekend called the evacuation process not only unfeasible, but incomprehensible under the present circumstances. So that doesn't seem to be going well, let's say. And it's unclear to what extent, certainly the Israeli government, the civilian cabinet, the Netanyahu's, the Smotrich's, the Ben-Gvir's, don't seem to care whether or not civilians get evacuated. Netanyahu probably wants to at least put on a display of evacuating people. But the IDF really does, I think, want people out of the way, not so much out of any commitment to preserving Palestinian life, but because it makes the operation, it will make whatever operations it needs to undertake easier if the civilians are out of the way. So there does seem to be a deliberateness on the part of the IDF. And this has caused, I think, internal arguments within the Israeli security establishment, where some of the more extremist members of the cabinet have been complaining that the IDF is taking too long. So that's an interesting development. The commander, Eyal Zamir, I think is his name, of the IDF, was newly appointed by Netanyahu this year because the sense was that he was a loyal yes man, that he would do what he was told when he was told to do it. But he's leading the pushback here and sort of insisting, initially was pushing back against this operation entirely, if we believe the reporting out of Israeli media, but seems to be the main force behind kind of keeping things at a slow pace. And as I say, that's led to some internal disagreements.
Well, speaking of the forced displacement of Palestinians, what signal do we get about the Israeli plans for Palestinians from this new Washington Post story this weekend detailing the Trump Riviera plan, transformation of Gaza into a very big mall?
yeah,
Neon 2.0
casino. I don't know. I mean, yeah, it's a, you know, resort destination. It's going to be great. And when I say great, I mean, it will be run by something called the Gaza Reconstitution Economic Acceleration and Transformation Trust, which the acronym is GREAT. yeah. So, I mean, the Washington Post reported on this. This is most of the details I found in this Post report, which was based on having gotten a copy of what they said was a 38-page prospectus for the Grand Riviera of the Middle East plan. Most of the details, I think, have been reported piecemeal in other places, but it was useful to have them all kind of compiled in this one report. And there were some details around, as you mentioned, the relocation, the voluntary, let's be clear, it's voluntary relocation, right, of Palestinians out of Gaza. You know, you can only kind of chuckle at the euphemisms. Jesus. Here. Yeah. So the main detail, I think, that to pull out of this is that the prospectus and the people who drew it up, who were from, you know, Tony Blair's people and the Boston Consulting Group, although the Boston Consulting Group has washed its hands of all of this. It's the same people who devised the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation scheme and have supposedly been fired from the BCG and were told operating on their own. They weren't consulting any of the senior partners, et cetera. But they have their prospectus highlights the cost savings that would accrue from encouraging Palestinians to leave Gaza altogether, because the alternative is to shelter them and provide for them during this entire reconstruction period, which it envisions about 10 years during which this territory would be under a U.S. trusteeship. And so the cost of kind of caring for the civilian population over that time sounds fairly prohibitive, but you could save, the estimate was around $23,000 per Palestinian who voluntarily, mind you, decides to leave the territory, and they would be enticed with some relative pittance in terms of Benny's benefit packages, a stipend for rent and food, a cash payment of, I think, around $5,000 as an inducement to get them to leave and go somewhere else. There's no judgment on where. At the end of this trusteeship, and this is where you can really tell this is all bullshit, the prospectus envisions 6 to 8 AI-powered smart cities erected across Gaza. So, I mean, this is fantasy, but I think the important thing to take from this is not that it lays out a realistic future for Gaza, but that it could very easily become the blueprint for ethnically cleansing the territory and the justification for it. So that's the thing to watch out for. And it was, I think, useful to see the report.
Can you imagine putting together the profit opportunities of ethnic cleansing PowerPoint, yeah, or slide deck or whatever?
And how cost effective it would be to just, you know, I wonder if you just killed everybody, that would probably be even more cost effective.
You don't even have to take care of them. Yeah. You can just banish them from this mortal plane. That is, that's some dark,
it's really
shit,
extraordinary,
man.
Yeah, the kind of mind that can sit there and put together that report is somebody who should be locked away and studied. I mean, really, like, you know, science should have a go at that.
Fully agree. Let's keep moving here. We're seeing some increased interest, particularly European governments, in recognizing a Palestinian state. Belgium is the latest, and Israeli government has given some signals about West Bank annexation. What are we seeing happen here? Why are we seeing this move towards recognizing Palestinian state?
Yeah, as you know, I mean, there's a number of countries now that have said during the UN General Assembly session later this month, they will recognize a Palestinian state. The Belgian government went a little bit further this week and said not only are they going to recognize a Palestinian state, they plan to announce what they called firm sanctions on the Israeli government. won't hold my breath to see what those will actually be. There have been a few responses. I mean, Benjamin Netanyahu has taken to, after ignoring this trend or, you know, just kind of issuing perfunct kind of statements, denouncing them initially. The snowball, I think, at this point has gotten big enough that he's getting really irritated. So he's taken to calling people, you know, leaders of countries that are planning to recognize Palestine, like Emmanuel Macron, the president of France, and, you know, the Belgian government. And he's taken to calling them basically, you know, terrorist lovers or terrorists themselves or Hamas, whatever. I don't entirely know, but he's really seems to be starting to get annoyed with this. The reactions to what is really just a symbolic gesture, because none of these governments are going to do anything to actually help stand up a Palestinian right. state. They're just checking off a box. But the reaction to this has gotten more intense. The Trump administration, for example, has now decided to not allow any Palestinian Authority officials to attend the UN General Assembly. It's revoked visas and has said it will not issue any new visas to PA personnel. Some of the Palestinian Authority's current UN delegation may be exempted from that. They're already in the country. But otherwise, they are preventing the PA from showing up. The administration has sanctioned the Palestinian Authority, and that seems to be the justification here for denying these visas. It's a huge violation of the UN's headquarters agreement, under which the U.S. is supposed to allow everybody in, barring any really unreasonable requests for visas. But the language in that agreement is so vague that the U.S. government can pretty much do what it wants. So that's one thing I think they're trying to, foreclose on the possibility of a big event or ceremony to kind of mark all these recognitions. The Israeli government, as you say, has actually declared that it, or is saying that it may annex the West Bank, or at least large portions of the West Bank. If you're going to call, if you're going to be jerks about this, then we're just going to have to be even jerkier and annex the West Bank. It's very childish response. You guys are going to
make us annex.
Yeah, you're going to make us annex the West Bank, which is kind of laughable, given the last several decades of Israeli policy. The contours of it are unclear. Smotrich, the finance minister, who's also the civilian official in charge of managing West Bank settlements, et cetera, says he's drawing up maps of various options for annexation. The Israelis have tried or sort of started down this road before. During Trump's first term, they were considering annexation of the Jordan Valley, which Trump stopped by negotiating all the Abraham Accords, under the terms of which Israel was supposed to agree not to annex the West Bank, especially with the UAE. We can come back to that. The maximal plan, from what I've seen, is to annex all of the West Bank except for the six largest Palestinian cities, which would be kind of isolated but kept under Palestinian control.
Man, I feel like nothing is gonna really doesn't help your case that you're not a part of like a colonial project to pull out the map and the Sharpie and
just start drawing lines on a map. There's still some reason to think that Netanyahu is gonna back off of this before he pulls the trigger, because it's sort of pulling back the curtain on what the Israelis have been doing de facto since 1967, and that could be uncomfortable for a number of reasons. For one thing, it makes the allegations, or what the Israeli government would still call allegations of apartheid, once you start annexing the West Bank formally and bringing potentially hundreds of thousands of Palestinians who have no rights, no voting, and you're not going to make them citizens, you're not going to give them any legal prerogatives, bringing them into the Israeli state, that's definitionally apartheid, and it takes things to a point where nobody's going to be able to really deny credibly anymore that this is an apartheid state. It puts responsibility for security, it kind of removes that the buffer of the Palestinian Authority as the manager of the Israeli occupation, and puts that responsibility directly on the Israeli government, which for a variety of reasons, I think Israeli leaders, at least the ones who are not messianic lunatics like Smotrich, don't want. So they don't want that responsibility to be directly foisted upon the Israeli government. So I have questions about whether Netanyahu will actually go through with this. He's been warned now by one of the participants in the Abraham Accord, as I mentioned earlier, the UAE, that annexing the West Bank would, or parts of the West Bank, would be a red line for the Emiratis, and that it could cause them to rethink normalization with Israel and the Abraham Accords. I suspect this is going to be a red line, the way that the invasion of Rafah was a red line for the Biden administration and the Israelis. If they do it, the UAE will just say, oh, well, they're not doing it the way that we were worried that they were going to do it, or whatever bullshit. And they'll find some reason not to, to, you know, cut off relations with the Israelis and to maintain the status quo.
While we're talking about grand Israeli plans, what am I seeing here about Israel building a new nuclear reactor?
So there's construction underway. There has been for a few years at the Shimon Peres Negev Nuclear Research Center, which is where Israel has a heavy water nuclear reactor that is definitely not producing plutonium for the nuclear weapons that Israel definitely doesn't have.
Definitely not.
No worries about that, obviously. So there's been construction for a few years, but it's there's new satellite imagery that shows that it's really kind of ramping up in a big way, and the contours of it have sort of taken shape, and most analysts, at least the ones that I read, seem to think that what they're doing is they're building a new reactor. The reactor that's currently on site was built in the 1960s, so, you know, probably not a bad idea to build a new one to replace it. As I say, heavy water reactors produce plutonium. Plutonium can be used as fuel for nuclear weapons if a country had a nuclear weapons program. And I'm not saying that Israel does, but if it did, then it could use plutonium as fuel for weapons. What I think is important to note about this, given recent events in the Middle East around Iran's nuclear program, which is regulated under the Non-Proliferation Treaty and the International Atomic Energy Agency, and Iran is obliged to open its nuclear facilities up for international inspection, the Israeli government never joined the Non-Proliferation Treaty and thereby is not subject to international monitoring. The IAEA, when asked about Israel's nuclear program or what's going on at the Shimon Peres Center, basically says, none of our business. They're not in the NPT. And I think that's an important lesson to take away for any countries that might be considering a nuclear program. Do you really want to open yourself up to eventually getting bombed by the United States because you have tried to play by the rules, or do you want to just break the rules with impunity the way that the Israelis have on this subject? You know, I know which one I would pick if I were in that situation. But
yeah, it seems like there's an obvious answer.
Yeah.
Let's say in the region, another important development related to Israel, though, the IDF killed the prime minister of the Houthi government in Yemen, and I believe also like a number of senior or prominent military and governing officials in the Houthi government. What happened here?
Yeah, it was mostly cabinet ministers, okay. Some of them in the security services, of course. But this was on last Thursday. The IDF bombed Sana'a, and there were rumors. It took a day or two before the fallout was really known, but there were rumors that they had targeted some kind of senior Houthi gathering or Houthi meeting of some type. It turned out to have been a session of the government that the Houthis have put in place in northern Yemen. And as you say, they killed the prime minister, Ahmed al-Rahawi. They killed a number of other cabinet members and senior figures. It's a major blow. I mean, you know, this is a head of government, not internationally recognized, but certainly the practical government in northern Yemen. It's a substantial blow for the Houthis to absorb in their administration of the territory that they control. Not a big military blow, though. I mean, these people were, for lack of a better term, civilian officials. And I can understand why people kind of chafe at that because of the nature of the Houthi movement and the fact that this is not an internationally recognized government. But, you know, as if you're going to distinguish between military and civilian, they were definitely on the civilian side of the organization. You know, their deaths, while complicating the administration of northern Yemen, really don't have any impact or shouldn't have much impact on the Houthi campaign against Red Sea shipping, against or the Houthis regular missile launches against Israel. And those have continued, probably as a show of statement of intent. The Houthis have actually stepped up, it seems like, their activities in the past, over the past week. They've attacked a couple of ships in the Red Sea. I don't think to any effect, but they've at least attempted it. They've launched a number of missiles toward Israel. I think most of those have been either intercepted or, well, I mean, none of them have made it to target, but most of them probably intercepted, and some just didn't get there. So, it hasn't really had much of an effect on that aspect of the Houthis operations. It may make it more difficult for the U.S. or, any other international actor to interact with the Houthis, which would make it similar to the Israeli strike that killed Hamas leader Ismail Haniyeh last July, in the sense that you're decapitating the civilian leadership. The military leadership's still there, but you're decapitating the people who talk to the outside world, making that process more difficult.
What would be the advantage of that from the Israeli perspective?
If they don't want to negotiate a settlement, I mean, it's the same as with Hamas. If they don't want to negotiate, then you make it impossible to negotiate by killing the negotiators. So in that scenario, if this was an intentional, it was intentionally done, that's probably the thought process behind it.
Let's move to other parts of the world, Derek. Indonesia, there were these mass protests I saw. I did not get a chance to dig in at all of what was happening. What was going on there?
Yeah, so there's been reporting in Indonesian media about basically the number of perks that politicians have, members of parliament have. And there was in particular reporting about a housing stipend that legislators gave to themselves last year that is 20 times what the average minimum wage worker in Indonesia would earn in a year. So this is just the housing stipend, 20 times what the average minimum wage worker would earn in a year, 10 times what the average minimum wage worker in Jakarta would earn in a year. And as you might imagine, people were not happy about this. And so, they took to the streets. There were protests. They escalated late last week. There were protests that began, I think, over the weekend or Monday maybe, and then continued all through last week. They really escalated on Thursday night when police killed a taxi driver while they were attempting to put down one protest in part of Jakarta. The protests at that point started to verge into riots. You had people breaking into and setting fire to regional parliament buildings across the country. At least four more people were killed over the course of the next several days. And so Prabowo Subianto, the president of Indonesia, announced over the weekend that these perks are going away. The housing perk and several others, actually, and pay increases that the legislators have granted to themselves as well, are being rolled back in response to this public opposition. So, we'll see if they follow through on that. But this is an interesting, I think, story to follow as people really kind of took to the streets in a country that has been fairly calm, I would say, of late. Prabowo is quite popular. Still quite popular. I don't think he's been dragged down by this because it's really attached to the parliament. But it was an interesting bit of unrest, and I guess a favorable outcome for the protesters. Although again, we'll see what actually happens.
So, Derek, I saw the headlines about a transition from Friends of the Pod, the private mercenary group Wagner, to Africa Corps for security purposes in the Central African Republic. And I think Moscow is urging them to go one way or another. But what's going on here?
It's sort of the end of an era. I mean, Wagner is largely defunct at this point because, of course...
R.I.P. Prigozhin.
When you rebel against the Russian state and you don't go all the way with it, Vladimir Putin then blows you up in an aircraft. Yevgeny Prigozhin no longer there. So what the Russian military has been doing, and it was already trying to do something like this, this is what sparked Prigozhin to attempt his. I hesitate to say coup. He was going after the defense establishment. Mm-hmm. They were trying to force Wagner mercenaries to sign contracts directly with the defense ministry and kind of cut Prigozhin out. And what they've done since then is create a kind of, you know, public-private entity called the Africa Corps to replace Wagner's functions in Africa, but with the direct oversight of the defense ministry. And they've been rolling this out across Africa. They rolled it out in Mali, I think in the Sahel broadly, but certainly in Mali. And now they're doing it in Central African Republic. And the Associated Press reported on this earlier this month, but also Quincy's Dan Ford wrote about it for Inkstick a couple of days ago, that they've run into some resistance in the Central African Republic because Africa Corps doesn't operate the same way that Wagner does. Wagner, Prigozhin, was willing to do contracts with these governments in Africa to provide security, quote unquote security, and, you know, the occasional massacre of civilians. It's, you know, it all comes, you take the good with that. Was willing to do this for, in return for assets. So, you know, they'd be given control over a gold mine or a, you know, this or that money making operation. But the Africa Corps wants cash. They don't want to deal with assets. They want cash. And not only, according to the AP, do they want cash as payment for Africa Corps to be in the country in the first place, they also want the Central African government to pay the costs of having Africa Corps personnel in the country. And this is an amount of money that the Central African government just simply may not be able to pay. Like, this is not a wealthy wealthy country or wealthy government, so it may be beyond their means. They've pushed back for that reason. They've also pushed back because Africa Corps' operating kind of procedures are significantly different from Wagner's. So where Wagner would go out and participate in the, let's say, counterterror operations, which also, as I say, include the occasional massacre of civilians, Africa Corps, because it's public, because it's at least quasi-public, I think there's more concern about potential casualties, kind of blowing back on the Russian government. So they're more interested in basically behind the lines roles, training, logistical support, that type of thing. Not so much in going out and doing the killing themselves. And this is also something that the Central African government is not terribly happy with. So they have pushed back. As Dan noted in his piece, this is not exactly a level playing field in terms of the negotiation between Central African Republic and Russia. The CAR doesn't have a lot of options, or maybe any other options, in terms of foreign security support. So they may feel compelled to agree to whatever terms Russia lays out. But I think it's notable that this transition from Wagner to the Africa Corps appears to be running into some difficulties as the Russians roll it out.
Sure. Let's stick in Africa here. The Congo River Alliance and M23 is accusing the government of the Democratic Republic of Congo of violating a ceasefire agreement. What happened here?
Right. We've talked about this on the show. The M23 militant group and the Congolese government were supposed to conclude a peace deal. They concluded what they called a statement of principles in July. They were supposed to sign a peace deal with Qatari mediation on August 18th and never actually went back and negotiated, resumed negotiations to get to that deal. So they're still in kind of limbo here as far as that agreement is concerned. They've been accusing one another of violating the terms of the statement of principles. The main objection from M23 has been that there was supposed to be a prisoner exchange that the Congolese government is not engaged in. But as you said, the leader of the Congo River Alliance, which is the umbrella group that includes M23, it really is M23. M23 is by far the most prominent member of this alliance. But the leader of that group, Corneille Nangaa, the political leader of it, accused the Congolese government earlier this week of multiple violations of the ceasefire agreement, including attacks on M23 fighters in South Kivu province, one of the two provinces that M23 largely controls in the Eastern Democratic Republic of the Congo. The Congolese government has been accusing M23 of attacking its positions. This is, I think, the most substantive accusation from the other side, that the military is doing the same thing. But it indicates, despite some recent optimism or optimistic statements from the Qatari government and suggestions that negotiations are back on track and everybody's still engaged. This is another indication that, that things have gone off the rails and a potential blow, of course, to Donald Trump's hopes of getting a Nobel Peace Prize, because he's been citing this conflict as one of the seven, I believe he says he's
yeah,
ended
we're up to seven now.
In just, you know, his first few months in office. Really, really just an amazing pace in terms of the peacemaking. And we all love it. He's such a great peacemaker.
Well, speaking of what the Trump administration is up to in the African continent, what is going on in Eswatini? There was an alarm sounded by some lawyers about five men who were trafficked there from the U.S. Would help us make sense of this.
Right. So the administration has a number of deals with African countries. Eswatini's one, South Sudan, I think Rwanda as well. And it's negotiated with others to serve as basically third party destinations for migrants whom it expels out of the U.S. and for whatever reason doesn't simply deport them back to their countries of origin, but decides to traffic to other countries around the world. It's done so, as you said, with five people so far to Eswatini. Their lawyers have sounded a major alarm here that these guys have been sent to Eswatini and imprisoned there without really being given access to counsel. They get sort of a very basic and I think unsatisfactory access to their lawyers. It's unclear why they're being imprisoned in Eswatini. They all have criminal records in the U.S., which was the justification for trafficking them elsewhere. But they had all served their sentences and been released in the U.S., so why they're now back in custody in Eswatini is unclear. And there's no legal process to speak of. I think there was supposed to be a hearing on Monday, and the judge just kind of didn't show up, so they couldn't have the hearing to even learn what the charge is or what their recourse is. So this is extraordinarily disturbing. You know, we already knew that the administration is doing really vile things to migrants, but this is just another example of that. These people are basically stuck in confinement in a place where they're not from. Supposedly their home countries wouldn't take them back, and that was the reason for trafficking them to Eswatini. But there's at least one of the five is a Jamaican national. The Jamaican government says it would have taken him back, so that seems to be a lie. So it's just all very I think Kafkaesque at this point.
The extraordinary renditions will continue until morale improves.
Yeah, exactly.
Insane. Let's move to Russia-Ukraine here. Where are we on the latest set of talks? I know there was a meeting from the so-called Coalition of the Willing in Europe today. I know that we've got some talk of security guarantees. Moscow has sent signals it will reject any foreign military presence that's put in Ukraine as quote-unquote peacemakers. What's going on here? What are the talks and negotiations what's going on?
Everybody's sort of punted on the negotiations. The Russians won't meet. Vladimir Putin won't meet with Zelensky. And people seem to think that for this conflict, for whatever reason, the only way to make any progress is to have the two presidents get together and discuss it rather than having lower level negotiations that build up to that, which is how most processes like this are supposed to go.
Right.
They're fixated on this idea that Putin and Zelensky have to meet. Putin did, I think, offer to host Zelensky in Moscow.
Jesus.
Zelensky said, no, I think I'll pass on that.
I think that's probably the right call.
Probably smart to do so. So, you know, that's going nowhere. And in the absence of any negotiations, the focus in the West and with the Ukrainians has turned to a very premature look at what kind of security guarantees could be offered to Ukraine in a post-war settlement. And I think basically because that's the thing that they can all sit around and talk about, and it looks like they're doing something to sort of advance to a post-war situation. And it's not true. It's not, they're basically spinning their tires at this point, but it still looks like they're keeping busy. And so, yeah, they've had, as you said, there was another coalition of the willing meeting in Europe today, Thursday. They've had a series of these, some of them involving Donald Trump, some of them just the Europeans and Zelensky. They've secured ostensibly U.S. support for a European deployment in Ukraine. What that would look like, it certainly wouldn't be a frontline kind of peacekeeping deployment, but it could be kind of a trainer slash reaction force if the Russians were to invade again. You know, they talked about putting a buffer zone in, which is just absurd. I think, you know, speaks to the fact that they really don't have any ideas here. The upshot is, as you said, the Russian government has repeatedly said it will reject any peace deal that puts foreign forces in Ukraine, or at least European forces. There may be some wiggle room outside of that, but who else would be willing? I don't even think the Europeans are necessarily willing to deploy military forces to Ukraine. Who else would be willing to do that? So it's been, they continue to have these talks, and the line has become, well, Russia doesn't get a veto over Ukraine's security guarantees, which, okay, I get that in principle, but like the Russians can just not agree to end the war.
They can just
so they do in fact have a veto over what happens here, whether you like it or not. I understand why that's unpalatable, but it is the way things are.
It seems like there is just like a continued allergy to like dealing with the real conditions of what's going on years later in diplomacy.
There's a hesitation. I mean, you can sort of read between the lines that the Ukrainians are coming to terms with the loss of territory, but you know what that would look like, or how much territory they're willing to part with, and Putin is not compromising. Which, I mean, you can understand, right? He can continue this for a while. I mean, it would probably be better for the Russian economy and for Russian society and the Russian military, which has to be exhausted at this point. If they could, you know, step down from this conflict, but at the same time, they can keep going if they don't get what they want. And so that's why you get, you know, his big concession at his summit with Trump was, well, if you give us the rest of the Donbass, we'll stop trying to conquer the other two provinces and just freeze the front line, which is not really a concession. But when you're in the position that the Russians are in, you don't have to make real concessions. And I think the Europeans and the Ukrainians are just sort of nonplussed at this point about what to do about that. They don't want to appear to be caving to outrageous Russian demands. But at the same time, what's the leverage, particularly with, you know, when Donald Trump keeps flopping back and forth between Russia and Ukraine, as he's wont to do, even with the U.S. On board to, you know, to impose sanctions, what's the real leverage and how far are they willing to go? Because they haven't really gone all the way. I mean, European governments and the U.S. have not pulled the trigger on anything that would, let's say, upend the global oil market or the energy security of European states in Ukraine's defense. And I don't think they would be willing to do that. So given those constraints that you've sort of imposed on yourselves, what is your leverage here? And I don't know what it is.
No, and meanwhile, Ukrainians themselves increasingly poll after poll, you know, won an end to the negotiated end of this conflict. Well, let's keep moving on what our dear President Trump is doing in
here's a fun story.
Off the coast of Venezuela this week, Trump ordered, if you look at the headlines, the quote obliteration of a drug smuggling boat. I mean, we just blew the hell out of a boat.
We bombed the shit out of that speedboat.
In the name of fighting quote narco terrorism. Tell us about this, Derek.
This was Trump kind of blurted this out. He was doing a press conference on Tuesday afternoon that I think, given all the speculation over the previous few days, was mostly a proof of life demonstration. Like, you know, I mean, ostensibly he was announcing the move of the U.S. Space Command headquarters from Colorado to Alabama. But it really seemed to be more like, hey, I'm still here. Like, J.D.'s not in charge, whatever. And he just kind of popped off during this press conference to say that the U.S. military had blown up a boat coming from Venezuela in the Southern Caribbean, ostensibly carrying drugs, ostensibly belonging to the Tren de Aragua gang, the Venezuelan gang that the administration asserts is directly run by Nicolas Maduro. When he's not, I guess, running Venezuela, he's a gang leader. And yeah, as you say, it's all justified under this heading of narco-terrorism, which is a new category that the administration has created that basically destroys any lingering definition of either narco or terrorism. Right. And they've declared Tren de Aragua a foreign terrorist organization. They assert that that gives them the legal justification to carry out attacks like this on, I guess, random speedboats in the Caribbean that the military decides are carrying drugs. There was a report in the New York Times that suggested this may have been a human smuggling boat, not a drug smuggling boat, which would mean that you've just killed a bunch of people for nothing. Certainly, you know, you're giving, they're asserting the right to just kind of kill people, on a criminal charge without due process, without, I mean, they could have interdicted the boat if they really thought it had drugs on it. But the explanation there from, I think, Marco Rubio was, well, this sends a message, to the drug cartels, and it sends a message to anybody with a speedboat, really, that don't get in your speedboat.
We're
in
the deterring Caribbean the
because
boaters.
You could just find yourself being drone bombed.
I mean,
at a moment's notice. So it's all very slippery legally, almost certainly not legal for the administration to do this. Or if you assume that it's legal, and by virtue of having designated this group a foreign terrorist organization, then it's legal to blow up a boat that you think belongs to it and you think might be carrying drugs, then they can just kill anybody they want because they can just make some statement that this person's a terrorist, which we've known the U.S. government has been verging on for a long time. But as with everything else, Trump has a way of clarifying things that smarter people try to obfuscate, and he's just sort of doing this out in the open and saying, yeah, we can pretty much kill whoever the fuck we want, and there's nothing you can do about it. And that seems to be the message here. Really, forget the message to the drug cartels or to the smugglers. It's the message is we can just kill anybody.
Sure, I'm glad that Democrats and Republicans spent the last 24 years giving the president wide
absolute authority
over the fight against terrorism. Yeah. Oh, good.
Fantastic.
Stuff. All right. We'll stay in the U.S. context here. There was an appeals court ruling against Trump on his magnificent, coherent tariff plan. What did the ruling say, and what does this mean for his, you know, attempts to remake the global trade order?
Yeah, he's gotten bad legal news in a couple of places over the past week. On Friday, last Friday, a federal appeals court ruled that his whole tariff scheme represents an unlawful use of the authority that he's assuming under the 1977 International Emergency Powers Act, which does give the president latitude to do things like impose tariffs without going through Congress if there is an international emergency. Just asserting that there is an international emergency is not necessarily legally binding, and the court ruled that there is in fact not an international emergency, and so the tariff justification, the legal justification, goes out the window. However, the court left the tariffs in place pending the inevitable administration appeal to the Supreme Court, where who knows? I mean, you know, it will likely find a more favorable reception at the Supreme Court, but we'll see. The other piece of bad news that came on Tuesday, late Tuesday, another appeals court, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, ruled that Trump's use of the Alien Enemies Act of 1798 as the legal justification for expelling Venezuelan nationals from the U.S. and, for example, trafficking them into Nayib Bukele's prison camp in El Salvador, mm-hmm. is without due process. It does not meet the standard required for invoking that act, because the act says the president has the right to arrest or deport foreign nationals in times of invasion or predatory incursion. But again, just sort of asserting that there's an invasion of Venezuelan gang members or migrants or whatever coming into the U.S. is not necessarily legally binding. And the court ruled that, in fact, there is no invasion or predatory incursion underway. And so the administration cannot fall back on the Alien Enemies Act to do this. Again, they will appeal this to the Supreme Court. The Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals is pretty conservative, as far as I understand. I am not a legal expert by any means. But I do wonder with this one, if they couldn't make a convincing case to that court, are they going to be able to convince the Supreme Court? But we'll see. Mm. This is much less load-bearing than the tariff thing. So, I know they'll appeal, but you know, even if they lose that appeal, it's not going to be a huge blow. But the tariffs, that would be pretty major.
All right, we'll keep our eyes on the court and keep you guys posted. All right, let's end this here with the new Cold War update.
New Cold War.
So there was the Shanghai Cooperation Organization meeting this past weekend and early this week in China. We saw some broing out between Xi Jinping and Vladimir Putin. There's also a VJ Day military parade that China was hosting. Tell us about what we saw across the ocean. I know the reception was a lot of hair on fire in the U.S. media, at least.
Yes.
About
oh, my God.
Emerging access.
Ridiculous. Yeah. I mean, I think what you saw over these two events, the SCO summit in Tianjin, and the VJ Day 80th anniversary of the signing, the Japanese signing the instrument of surrender at the end of World War II, the message in sum was that China is on the world stage, and she is a leader of a great power to whom leaders of other countries come to sort of pay homage, just like the president of the United States. So the statement, I think, was pretty clear. The SCO summit focused primarily on Xi's suddenly improving relationship with Narendra Modi, the Prime Minister of India, and you know, India kind of hedging, I think, its recent turn toward the United States in the wake of Donald Trump imposing 50% tariffs on Indian products, abruptly just getting enraged at Modi. Right. We've talked about this before. I mean, he says it's because India is buying Russian weapons and oil. I think it's because Modi denied that Trump had anything to do with ending the most recent India-Pakistan conflict. And he just got offended by that. But regardless, this seems to have upended what is really a decade or more of U.S. foreign policy in the Indo-Pacific to try and cultivate ties with India, and really seems to have just set things back quite a bit. And so now you have Modi kind of, you know, traveling to China for the first time in years to participate in this summit, having, you know, meetings with Xi and public sessions where he and Xi and Vladimir Putin are sort of performing their mutual broing out, as you say, for the cameras. The message was clearly received. Donald Trump took to social media on Monday as this was playing out to angrily call the U.S.-India relationship a totally one-sided disaster. Right. So clearly he got the message, was not terribly thrilled with it. Then, yeah, things continued on Wednesday with the military parade that she held to mark the 80th anniversary of Japan's World War II surrender. Most of the hair on fire reporting in the U.S. media was about the military hardware. And I get the sense that there's some undercurrent of feeling that it's not fair for China to have an army or a navy, like to have military hardware, because it was all like, oh, wow, look at all this stuff they have. They're not supposed to have that stuff. Yeah. What the hell? And so, you know, there's that. But the bigger message, I think, was, again, the portrayal of Xi as this as a real globe-bestriding colossus. Right. Putin was there again, and Putin is you know, really a client at this point of Xi's and China's. Mm-hmm. Kim Jong-un was there. The three of them were the main focus. Modi was not. So it was Kim and Putin and Xi broing out and, you know, kind of going for a long walk together and riding in some kind of, I didn't pay attention to all the details, but just making these displays of their kind of mutual chumminess. Sure. Trump again took to social media.
This is a good one.
And posted a message to Xi asking him, and I'm quoting here, to please give my warmest regards to Vladimir Putin and Kim Jong-un as you conspire against the United States of America. I mean, I think he was, you know, a little tongue in cheek there, but I'm sure you're familiar with the concept of kidding on the square, where you make a joke but you really mean it.
Right.
I suspect there was some of that going on,
yeah, a little
behind Trump's message, a little hurt feelings, especially with Kim. I mean, he and Kim are so close, and he's been getting frustrated with Putin too, as he and Putin seem to have their own bro thing happening, but Putin's, you know, kind of stabbed him in the back a few times on Ukraine at this point, so he seems to be irritated there as well. But again, I think the importance is just the display of China as a genuine world power on the global stage, rivaling the U.S.
Yeah, and like you said, the like media is sort of pointing at the rule book and is like, a dog can't play basketball, like a communist can't have an army or whatever. Like,
yeah, I mean, that was the other thing with the undertone of the reporting about the like broing out parts, or like, wait a minute, the bad guys aren't allowed to talk to each other. What the hell? Yeah. Like, you guys can't have a relationship with each other, and it's just so weird. I mean, it's very anachronistic, I think, but these things are embedded in the U.S. media, that like the U.S. is the only country that really gets to act, and everybody else is just exists in theory on paper, right, out there somewhere.
Yeah.
But they're not fully, you know, human, or and they don't have you know, the ability to act on their own,
right?
Subject form alliances, or right, exactly. So I think we're still stuck in that mindset, which was reflected in all this report.
As Antony Blinken said in 2023, like, only America can put its hand on the rudder of history and steer us forward.
Yeah, and steer us right into a fucking brick wall.
Exactly. Well, that feels like a good note to end it on.
So, Alex, tell people about your show. I know you're here, and I think you may be here next week. I don't want to spoil things for you. I don't know if you were aware of that.
But, count me in, brother.
Danny's probably still going to be in his hair shirt, kneeling outside the Kremlin.
Of course.
trying to get out from under
self-flagellating. So, yeah, I know.
Yes, exactly. It's tough. Exactly. So, but tell people about your show and where people can find
it. Yeah, absolutely. So myself and Courtney Rawlings, both at the Quincy Institute, we host a show called Always at War, and we're looking at the various material, emotional, cultural forces that keep America launching constant military interventions from the Caribbean coast to Sudan, to sending weapons everywhere, being the number one weapons arms dealer in the world. You know, just looking at the American military state, the NATSEC state, and the constant interventions, and trying to unpack a little bit about why it happens and why it is so manifestly shitty for Americans that we keep doing this instead of investing in ourselves ever. So yeah, the show is called Always at War. It's findable on any of your podcast apps, our YouTube as well, where we try and put in some fun visuals and old historic clips and artifacts that I think listeners to the show would enjoy. So yeah, just look it up, Always at War, wherever you are finding your podcasts, or check it out on YouTube.
Awesome. So we will have that. We'll have links to the show in the show notes as well. And I just want to say to everybody, thanks for listening. I think, and I am the last person to know about scheduling, but I think we've got a couple of bangers coming out in the next few days. We've got, I won't spoil them, but we've got a bonus coming out on Sunday that is going to be free to everybody. So keep an eye out for that. If you're not an American Prestige subscriber, keep an eye out for that. You will still get, I think, this weekend's bonus and next week's regular episode. Also a banger, so please keep an eye out for that. And if you enjoy the show, if you enjoy these next couple of interviews, please share them with friends and family, anybody who you think might be interested. We're trying to make the pie higher, as George W. Bush might say. here at American Prestige. So please do that. And yeah, that's it. Take care, everybody. Keep on rocking in the free world. We'll see you next week.